The views expressed on the following live program do not necessarily reflect those of KSCO Radio, its staff, management, or advertisers. If something is said with which you disagree, please call us during the program in order to help us balance comments.
That music's a couple days early, don't you think? This is Richard Quigley, KSCO AM, Santa Cruz 1080. I'm sitting in for whoever would be sitting here if it wasn't me today. I'm going to be out of town Thursday, and so this is my penance, is to come in and visit KSCO's Tuesday crowd. Call-in lines are area code 831-479-1080. 477-1340 if you got a fax you want to send me, 475-2967. I read them all, try to respond as best I can. And today I got a few things. One of them popped up on the news just a while ago, and so the segue into that's going to be this announcement that this is National Victims' Rights Week. And yeah, Santa Cruz District Attorney Bob Lee said his office has started some new programs. I think what my recommendation to Mr. Lee would be is that he start by getting rid of an old problem. There's a guy down there by the name of Dave Ginocchio. And Dave's been pounding around in the DA's office for, oh, Lord, as far back as I can remember. He was one of the first guys in the Danner administration, and he's been steadfastly there through, this is what, the fourth district attorney. And right now, Dave's in an interesting position. He is the, what they call a filing deputy. And Dave Ginocchio gets to decide what cases go to court and what cases don't go to court. Am I doing something wrong, Rosemary? I've got somebody sneaking up on me. I did something. What did I do? Okay, do that and speak up. Okay, I can do that. I'm sorry. Anyway. So, Mr. Ginocchio, he's down there now, and he's the filing DA. And I've had my differences with Dave over the years, and it's nothing to do with him prosecuting me or any of that kind of stuff. It actually has to do with his rude behavior as a bureaucrat. He really is quite an unbearable jerk, in my humble opinion. Always willing to stand corrected, so the Dave Ginocchio fan club phone calls are welcome. But fact of the matter is, I don't have much regard for this guy. I know that last year he got a complaint in his hands from a guy that came onto a property that I just happened to know about. And the guy removed the gate from the property, stole a bulldozer, took it off the property, took it over to his place to save a piece of equipment that he'd run off the road, and drove the bulldozer back onto the property and replaced the gate. And when the police report was finally written on that thing a couple of years later, and it was only turned over to the police because he refused, even though he kept saying he was going to fix it, he refused to fix it. It was finally turned over to the sheriff's office. The sheriff's office filed a report, sent it to the district attorney, and in the report, the deputy explained that he had talked to this guy and that the guy had explained that he had stolen the tractor, but that he'd returned it. And, of course, the estimated $5,000 worth of damage to this bulldozer, he just discounts that by calling it a rusted piece of junk, which, of course, it wasn't on the day that he stole it to save whatever piece of equipment he was saving. But in any case, that complaint moved through the sheriff's office, as they do, and then they're referred to the district attorney from there. That's the process by which these criminal cases generally start. And then when it gets to the DA's office, the filing deputy looks through it and makes sure there's enough evidence to make the case fly, and then they decide to go ahead, you know, and the process is more complicated than that, but essentially, far too often, it comes down to the decision of one man. Now, because I was referenced in this police report, Dave Ginocchio was motivated going in to see that justice wasn't done, victims' rights be damned, and the short version is that he decided to do a no-file. The sheriff's office went back to him and said, wait a minute, you got a confession to two felonies. Stealing the tractor, whether you returned it or not, does not keep it from being the theft of a tractor, is a felony. Removing a gate to commit a felony is a felony. And this lad had admitted to doing both. Why aren't you going to file? And Mr. Ginocchio just flat didn't file. Well, this morning, I'm sitting at the house minding my own business, and I get a phone call, and there was a case that came up here recently in Corralitos. There was an elderly lady over there, apparently pretty well-to-do, that had hired some folks local there in Watsonville of Mexican ancestry, and they went to work taking care of her. She'd gotten to the point where she couldn't move around and take care of herself in her house anymore, and she needed someone there. And so they started working for her, and almost immediately, because they'd been working with invalid people for a long time, they offer health, you know, home care for invalids. Because they'd been doing that long time, something about their bookkeeper sort of struck them as a little odd. So they started complaining that they were seeing things from the person that was taking care of this lady's money that indicated that she might not be on the up and up. Next thing you know, they get a visit from Officer Dave Deverell, one of my favorite bad cops. And we won't go into all the reasons why I don't care much for Deverell, but the long and the short of it is that these people ended up being run off, the ones that were trying to snitch out this stealing book, this bookkeeper that was stealing all this money, or reported to be stealing the money. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know. All I know is that the evidence strongly suggests. Anyway, these... first thing that happened, of course, they get investigated. There's a warrant issued, and they do a search on these people's house. And during the course of this search, they ran across some chickens in the backyard. And so now they've decided that even though they didn't find anything in there to indicate that these people were anything but honest, upstanding citizens, and that their relationship with this lady and Corralitos was nothing but the best, they decided that they were going to put them on trial for raising chickens. And I think it's under some sort of a gamecock statute. So they're down there just prosecuting the fire out of them. At the same time, the woman that stole all the money, the latest word that I get from inside that giant gray-looking building down there is that Dave Ginocchio is not going to file any charges against the woman that they have evidence stole over $90,000 from this lady, because the victim's dead. So I don't know how that fits in, but apparently that's Ginocchio's story, and he's sticking to it. And if you knew him like I do, you'd understand that it doesn't have to be anything even bordering on sense for him to stick to it. So there you go. That's my opinion, National Victims' Rights Week. Until we are protected from people stealing from our old and dying, I don't think that we can claim that we're doing anything toward building new programs for victims' rights. So, rant one out of the way. Two, I'm sitting here this morning reading about this meeting down here at town hall meeting. This anti-war stuff. You guys just won't quit. Please. I'm gonna make a couple suggestions here, man. I'm gonna point out some stuff, and then I'm just gonna ask. And if you don't do it, fine. I don't care. You know, it's your town, it's your future. But I'm reading the article. This is from the Sentinel. Dan White apparently attended this meeting, and everybody's down there having a big snit, like Santa Cruz's opinion of what's going on halfway around the world is gonna make a difference. But I mean, it could, but not like this. Anyway, a staff member for USAMFAR, Rep. Sam Fart, says here, read a prepared statement about the Bush administration's, and then a, quote, arrogance and disregard, and likened it to a, quote, cage of hawks. The Bush administration continues to set up America for a troubling, war-ridden future. Well, I don't know. Is that... We're talking about a Democrat here. Does that mean he's a liberal? And if he's a Democrat and he's a liberal... Doesn't the leading voice for that party today, at least from the echo chamber of the next room, happen to be a guy by the name of Bill Clinton? Because I was amazed Sunday night when I sat there, not really amazed, to be honest with you, because sometimes Bill will do the right thing in spite of his testosterone levels. But Sunday night, 60 Minutes, the debate weekly joke, they call a debate between Senator Dole and President Clinton. And Dole came out, of course, support the president, support the war. Let's get this thing over with and get our kids back home. And lordy, lordy, here comes President Clinton. And I do agree, Senator, our troops, commanders should have our support and our patience, especially in a conflict that's only 2 weeks old. He goes on for a couple other paragraphs and finishes with, but now it's enough to know that our military is in the world's finest, know that our military is the world's finest and wonderful young men and women of every race, religion, and walk of life. They'll do what they've been asked to do, and they deserve our support. About that, there can be no debate. That's Bill Clinton. And thank you very much, as if he cares what I think one way or the other. And I think it's interesting that a voice from the left comes out so squarely against these the effects of these war protests. I realize he didn't say no more war protesting, so don't start picking nits with me. The fact is that the Bill Clinton clearly supports getting behind the president and his action over there until it's done. Now, as to what I would recommend that the people on the left, these war protesters, do with their time and energy, because I, for one, appreciate the time and energy. I think it's misguided, and I think it's misplaced. Not my business to tell y'all how to devote your lives. But here's my recommendation. Take that energy and get together in groups, whether you call them coalitions or caucuses or whatever you want to do, and work out some ideas. Figure out, look at how it is that we got set up. Because to me, it appeared like Bush was moving without quite as much consent or overseeing that as I wanted from the Congress. And I know that the Congress says that only the Congress can declare war. The Constitution says only the Congress can declare war. So I'm looking at Bush going into this thing, and I'm thinking, it's a little bit fast. And as most of you know, before the war started, I was having a lot of reservations about it, which I haven't had since. But what the liberals can do, what these progressives can do, in my estimation, that would be a great benefit, is to go through and find out what happened, how these things came to pass, and then affect the methodology, not with protests, but with elections and putting in good candidates and supporting good ideas. You know, use the system the way it's designed to work. It is a subversive methodology to just destroy, badmouth, destroy, not offer anything positive. And to that end, I don't see that there's any room to have a lot of regard for the war protesters. But to get inside and work within the system to fix the system and make it healthier and better, that's what my whole existence is about. So, of course, I'm going to endorse it. And, of course, this is my point of view, which is that of Richard Quigley. And this is KSCO AM 1080. The call-in lines are 479-1080, 477-1340. I'll be more than happy to entertain your views on that and other subjects. And now I'm going to move to what I'm doing Thursday, because my Thursday hour down here is one that I look forward to weekly. And I think I've even started to develop a bit of a, it's Thursday, let's turn on the radio kind of audience, which is kind of nice. But this Thursday, I'm not going to be here. Why, you ask? Well, I'm going to be in Nevada. And I'm going to be sitting in the Senate Transportation Committee at 1 o'clock Thursday afternoon. And I'm going to be talking to the state of Nevada about the reasons why they should repeal their helmet law. Now, figure any way you want. That's what I'm going there for. Anybody that knows me knows that I've been involved in fighting California's helmet law since its inception. A lot of people don't know why. Today I might have enough time to actually get into that. But what happened was is that a couple of years ago I was with the Nevada thing. A couple of years ago I was invited over to Nevada to attend a freedom rally over there of a bunch of bikers that don't like the mandatory apparel. And so I showed up for the Freedom Ride, and we went out and we rode. And during the course of the ride on the way back home, finally one of Nevada's finest, the Highway Patrol, decided that they could no longer put up with me riding down the road with what did not appear to them to be a helmet. Now, my helmet looks very much like a baseball cap, and it has been a source of confusion for police officers throughout Santa Cruz County, at least for the first couple of years. It remains a source of confusion for judges, because they get all mixed up between what they think is righteous and what is the law. And so I'm get pulled over by this just great cop. And I mean, he's a wonderful cop. I'd heard some terrible things about Nevada Highway Patrol. I'm here to tell you they ain't so. It's not to my experience. Maybe it's if you act right, it ain't so. But to my experience, these are great cops. The short version, if there were a short version of anything that I tell stories about, but the short version is that he wrote me a ticket. Now, I made him write on the ticket that his objection to my headgear was is that it was not DOT approved. I wasn't wearing a DOT approved helmet. And I asked him carefully, I said, now you're sure that the law, Nevada law, requires that I wear a DOT approved helmet? He said, that's correct. And I says, well, if that's your belief, young man, you go ahead and write the ticket, and we'll just see where it goes from there, you know. And so he writes the ticket, and I sign it, and everything's copacetic. And so I says, now what? And he says, well, what do you mean? I says, well, I got to get to town. It's about a mile from here to there, and I don't have any other helmet but this one. Are you just going to pull up down there ahead of me and stop me again, and we'll do this 100 feet at a time or a quarter mile at a time? Or, I mean, how am I going to do this? And he said, well, no. He says, I can't let you ride away without a DOT-approved helmet. It's like, whoa, no, that won't work, because it just between you and me and everybody that's listening, there's no such thing. DOT never approved a helmet. They're never going to approve a helmet, which is why all these helmet laws are bogus. But anyway, so now he won't let me ride away. I'm 500 miles from home in another state. Now, I know that this is a serious matter, because interstate travel is one of the most protected rights that we have. And so I'm sitting here and I'm looking at a perfectly fine police officer, but he's telling me that I got to do something that can't be done before I'm allowed to move my motorcycle back toward my home, which is 500 miles from where I'm at. So I loaded in a truck and go and everything. We parked company fine. His supervisor showed up and he agreed that that was the state of the law and everything was great. Okay, so off and down the road I go. Again, I'm abbreviating this because we got to get it into this time. But the next thing that happens is that the district attorney there in Battle Mountain, Nevada, refused to prosecute the cases. So my relief on the issue of what I was to do to comply with the law went away. Through the traffic court, I couldn't do it there. So then I wrote to the administrators within the Department of Motor Vehicles and Highway Patrol, and I asked them one question. I said, "How can a motorcyclist comply with certainty?" And that's the kind of certainty that it takes to prove that what I'm doing complies with the law. So what can I do to comply? What can a motorcyclist do to comply with certainty with the provisions of Nevada's helmet law? And by the time the conversations were over, and we wrote back and forth for about a year and a half, what the answer was is that they really didn't have an answer to that question. And so the head of the Highway Patrol turned it over to the Attorney General and said, this man's got a question, and we need it for enforcement. We don't even know how to enforce this thing with certainty, you know, now that we realize there's no such thing as a DOT-approved helmet. So the district attorney last November wrote an opinion in which he points out that the statute doesn't work. It needs to be fixed. The fines are too harsh. It's actually a misdemeanor to be riding to violate the helmet law in Nevada. And California is a correctable equipment violation. So, and the reason for all this, again, is to tell you how laws are made. It's kind of fun. The Attorney General says that the law is messed up. They can't be enforced. And I write to the head of the Highway Patrol. I said, well, that doesn't really help us. I know you sent for that opinion. Now what? And he says, well, he says, I can't do it. But he says, if you'd get some people together and go to the legislature, I'll be more than happy to come testify that the statute is unworkable. It's like, wow, okay, so I can do that. So I did. I put the people together that I'd taken that ride with, and we go to the legislature, and a bunch of strings are pulled. And the next thing you know, The legislative council, these are the people that give it legal advice to legislators. The bill that was originally proposed to them was an exemption that exempted riders over 21 years from wearing helmets. But they had already been contacted by me, and I had already explained to them that they had no definition for a helmet, so that any attempt to use helmet or headgear in their statute was going to fall because there was no standard for compliance. Now, what I'm talking about, so that you guys can understand it a little better, Say, for example, that we took all the speed limit signs that are in the state of California right now, and instead of speed limit and a number, they just put up signs that said no speeding. Now, that would all come down to the officers deciding whether or not you were speeding, and there is no objective standard. So when I'm talking about a helmet, the same thing. There is no objective standard. There is no 35. There is no 55. There is no 65 or equivalent thereof. So it's just a guessing game. It's whether or not that officer believes that whatever headgear complies with a complex set of federal standards that were meant to be applied to manufacturers. So anyway, that's where we're at. The bill came out of the Ledge Council's office as a repeal bill, and so I get to go up there and talk to those guys on Thursday and kind of look them in the eye and say, look, you can either take this thing out because it's a bad law and it violates the rights of citizens because we don't have any notice as to what behavior is expected, or I'll walk across the street, go into federal court, and with the testimony that I have, the AG's opinion, with the head of the Highway Patrol saying that the statute's unenforceable, it'll be a lockdown, shutdown, no big problem to get the federal court to enjoin its enforcement. So that's what I'm going to be doing Thursday, and that's why I won't be here in 2 days to do my show. So now what I need to do is take a break. It's about 20 minutes till the hour. This is KSCO Talk Radio. Can't tell from the number of calls we've taken lately, but it's 479-1080, 477-1340. You can fax me at 475-2967. And right now what we're going to do is we're going to punch a button here and see if we can find something to listen to along lines of a commercial.
Exchange Solutions reminds listeners that news of global conflict...
Well, that's what commercials sound like. That's fun. Okay. All right, so now I'm going up, and I'm going to do Nevada on Thursday. We got that covered, and we've got a filing district attorney down at the district attorney's office that I'm not real happy with, and we got that covered. Planning department. Should we dare take on the planning department? Do we have enough? If there's anybody out there that would like me to take one road or another, go ahead and give me a call because I'm kind of floating here. I will go back and talk a little bit more about the helmet law because some of you folks may not know that when you look around and you see this old guy riding around with nothing on his head, you're right, that's me. I'd appreciate it if you didn't run over me. I'm just doing the best I can to save what limited freedoms we have left. 1991 is when California got its mandatory helmet law for adults. A lot of people don't know that the helmet law in California originally came in 1988, and it's a byproduct of the combination of the shooters and the socialists. And for you who don't know what the shooters are, I talked about them for the first time last Thursday, and I got a fax that explained that I'm an idiot because I have this concept of shooters, but they are the people that you should do this and should do that and should do the other thing. And when we talk about their effect on our society, it looms large. It gets pretty bad. They are the foundations and the root of the liberal fascism. And when I talk about liberal fascism, everybody looks at me like, well, everybody knows liberals aren't fascists. That's the conservatives. Oh, yeah. Bill Clinton put more cops on the street than any other president in the history of the United States of America. And he didn't do that because he found better ways to deal with people than to police them till they tip over. But anyway, so back to 1991. The liberal fascists and the shooters got together, and they found a guy by the name of Dick Floyd, a rather despicable legislator. He was an assemblyman from down around the Compton area, and he just... slimy. I mean, he just slimy. He got the helmet law in for people 15 and a half and under in 1988. In 1991, he first time successfully got a bill through the legislature that would exempt riders over 21 from being exempted. In other words, to make the law apply to all adults. Now, back in the 70s, when having helmet laws was all the rage and the government was involved in mandating it through the blackmail of withholding road taxes, At one point, every state in the United States except California had a helmet law. Now, there's less than 20 states or just 20 states that have mandatory helmet laws for adults. And although many of them still have helmet laws for young people, it's just because they're too stupid to know. And so Dick Floyd, he goes into the legislature, and I don't know how many of you remember 1991 was one of those years when we were having financial problems. Nothing like what's been put on us by Gray Davis, but finances were being talked about a lot. And he shows up with this theory that putting helmets on motorcyclists as a matter of law would save the taxpayers of the state of California $66 million a year. And there's a reporter by the name of Bernard Bauer used to write for the Santa Cruz Mercury News. He might be over there. I mean, San Jose Mercury News. He might be over there now, still, as a matter of fact. And he did some research on this, and he checked with all the sources that Dick Floyd cited. And he contacted the assemblyman after a couple of weeks of research and said, excuse me, Assemblyman Floyd, but I call these people that say that you cited as giving you these numbers that they're talking about all these expenses, and they say that they didn't give you those numbers. In fact, that no such numbers even exist. There is no public burden number that can be assessed to people wearing or not wearing helmets. And Floyd, then this is the quote that got me in the helmet law fight. You know, I'm accused of being obsessive compulsive, and I'll admit to the, I don't know what compulsive really means, I guess, but I'll admit to being obsessive. But his response to that inquiry, just shocked me. How do you answer that, Assemblyman Floyd? How do you deal with the fact that everybody says you just made up the numbers? And Dick Floyd, a California state assemblyman, used language I can't use. I can't even quote him here on the air. I'm just going to give you an around it. We're not going to get anybody in trouble. But his response was, who gives a expletive deleted? Now, it starts with F and ends with K and has a C and a U somewhere in the middle there. But you get, he said, they'll wear the hats or they go to jail. And I picked that up in the newspaper in 91, and I looked at that, and I said, what? And again, those of you that have been around me for a while know that I come by these things slowly, and I got into this whole freedom-fighting business one step at a time. But this type of thing, I had no idea. I had no idea this is the way we could make law. And I took one look at that, and I said, no, not in my state. Whether I was affected by it or not, this is not the way that we make law. You just don't go in and lie and then just blatantly flaunt the fact that you lied and then have a statute that everybody has to live with. And if that's the way it is in this state, then I think that it's broken and it needs to be called the attention to people, which is exactly precisely what I'm doing today. In line with snitching out government and complaining about what they do to us and the like, there's somebody here on line one, I think. Bruce, are you there?
I might be.
Yeah, Bruce, talk to me.
Okay. How many times have you heard that Californians like the number 7 or the number 6 or the number 5 economy in the world?
Oh, yeah. Isn't that, those numbers float around.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. We're one state in the United States, and if any president is stupid enough to withhold traffic funds to influence us, it's the governor of California, really, who buckles under. But the thing is, helmet law, how many times have they threatened to withhold highway funds? We should say, screw them. You know, we'll provide our own highway funds.
Well, absolutely. And of course, if they didn't get the funds in the first place, they wouldn't be able to hold a disproportionate amount of them back.
Well, if the government of California was antagonistic to the federal government, then they would start listening to us.
Yeah, absolutely. Which by the way, when in 1978, and you'd almost have to refresh my memory as to who was governor, but the governor told them when they wanted to come in and force them to put in a helmet law in 78, it was pound sand. And in 1988 and 89 and 90, there were helmet bills that passed through the legislature, that got past the legislature, that were slated to go into effect with the signature of the governor. And Duke Majan consistently, year after year after year, vetoed those bills. It wasn't until Pete Wilson, who is one of the shames of the Republican Party. You know, I mean, this guy just oozes Nazi. Got into position that we ended up with a helmet law. By the way, this is KSCO 1080 AM Santa Cruz 479-1080,
477-1340. Okay, I mentioned that myself.
Are the call-in lines? You were going to mention what yourself, sir?
I was going to mention that this is a KSCO 1080 and
I'm sorry,
KMY 10.
Yeah, 1340. I'm not on KMY, but that's okay.
Okay.
So, yeah.
But the point is this. They're using those same federal funds to pound us, and we buckle under, and why? You know, let them pound sand.
Yeah.
Let the federal government make an enemy of California and see what happens.
I believe me. That, you know, same thing with tobacco. Same thing with tobacco. You know,
wait.
Go ahead.
Okay. Now, these tobacco taxes that were passed and
sure.
fines, penalties.
Yeah.
Thing is, tobacco smokers already pay their way.
Yeah.
They live a certain number of years less than the average person, and that is deducted from Social Security.
Yeah.
And from Medicare.
Yeah.
And they already, see, they pay into it, but they don't get it.
Well, and it wouldn't, none of it would be an issue if we weren't into socialized medicine and socialized medicine. How the hell do we become a socialized medicine thinking government? I mean, how do we get there? I don't understand that one, you know, but you become, because they have socialized medicine. Now, everything that you do, the government thinks they have a right to interfere with. And we need to start working on getting that part of it backed off and the thinking that goes with it. But the shooters won't allow it.
Well, what the state of California needs is, an initiative to tell the federal government they can keep their highway funds and they can never threaten us with it again.
Yes, sir. And just one move anywhere along the way. Bruce, I thank you very much for your call. I'm glad you called in. Took a little bit of the weight off me, and I look forward to seeing you maybe on Thursday sometime. Give me a call.
Thanks.
Anyway, I was about to go into my rant on what happened on tobacco. Tobacco is really an amazing story. Tobacco is an amazing story. All of these bills that they've got on us, this $5 a carton sin tax that you folks put on us, you know, that the voters or the government put on us, this $5 a carton sin tax, which manifests itself as almost $10 in cost. That was put on us because, you know, future medical expenses. So we're going to do all that. And this whole thing could have get nipped in the bud if Philip Morris had their heads together when this Florida case came up. When the state of Florida sued the tobacco industry for all these future medical expense claims and all that junk, if in response to that suit, the tobacco industry had stopped immediately selling tobacco into Florida, we'll just tell you what, we'll stop. Their lawyers have their lawyers go, we will not sell any more tobacco into Florida until this matter is settled. It wouldn't have been settled, and it wouldn't have been settled with this kind of a bigoted behavior being exhibited towards smokers, all these extra taxes being put on smokers. And I'm not talking about a reasonable tax. I'm talking about an abusive tax. And there's no way that anybody can claim that a tax imposed on a pack of cigarettes, the proceeds of which are used to make an advertisement to explain what an idiot the guy is that paid the tax in the first place, is just a little over the top where I come from. I think that we have a right to complain about that. I think that we have a right to say that, you know, that is the underbelly of a democracy. That's why we live in a republic. That kind of stuff should never have been allowed to happen. And the reason that it was is because there are not enough people that will stand up for their rights, and there are too many people that while they're waiting for somebody else to stand up for their rights, let these things float away. Silence gives consent. And if there's anything that I hope to accomplish from the appearances that I make here at this radio station on my little Thursday 45-minute show, you know, that they're allowing me to do for now, it will be to inspire people to get involved at some level. At some level. When you find out, for example, that the kids that are coming to school at Watsonville are being lined up outside the school and they're being searched like a pat-down search inside a prison. And they're going through these kids' book bags and stuff, and these officers are coming by, and they just dump the contents of the bag out on the ground and then look all through it and then walk away and let the kid figure out how to put everything back in the bag. I mean, it's not dehumanizing, but it is not respectful. And you do not raise a society of young people that will respect you by for their language, dissing them. You cannot be disrespectful to someone and expect them to give you respect in return. It just doesn't happen. It's not as a practical matter. It will never happen. And so as a citizen and you hear about these things, come on, just, you know, speak up. Find out if you really will get clubbed over the head, because you'll be amazed. You can really get involved, and you can direct the people that govern you, and they'll make it complicated and they'll make it difficult, but they won't make it impossible. The First Amendment still has teeth, and you can still get in and you can still get the word done. And you don't need to wait until you can get a group of people. Swear to you, you don't need to. Pick up the telephone today. I want to bring Kim Allen from the sheriff's office down here to the studio, and I want to do a 45-minute show with him on a Thursday afternoon where we discuss how it is that you and I are supposed to act when an officer pulls us over or approaches us to deal with some criminal matter or something that is police business. How can we best conduct ourselves so that we bring a minimum amount of grief onto that officer and concern for his safety, so that we bring a minimum amount of grief on ourselves, and how can we do it in a way that protects us and protects everybody? This is a safety issue, and I've been pushing down there trying to get the sheriff's office to send Kim down here to do this show, and I'm getting a wee bit of resistance. So do me a favor, you know, come on, pick up the phone, call down there and see if you can do it. I'm looking here on my screen. It says, caller says you can't use the system. The system is broken. Hello? And then they went away? Okay. Scalia said you can't use the system. The system's broken. Yeah, I don't know. You know, that's likely to be true. Judge Danner decided that the standard for a motorcycle helmet was a matter of common objective experience. When faced with the same problem they had in Nevada came back and said, yeah, you're right, Mr. Quigley, that statute just doesn't make any sense unless we have something to define a helmet. We all thought there was a DOT-approved system, but there isn't, and so we're going to take out the statute. I put those same arguments in front of the district attorney and Art Danner here in Santa Cruz County, and they come back with this notion of the standard to determine what a helmet is common objective experience. Now, since the nature of experience is that it's subjective, for those of you that do understand what the language means and you're trying to figure out what an objective experience is, it is, in fact, a non sequitur. You've got to set that thing up with some twisted definition of the words to get there. There's no common objective experience. There can't be. So if that's the standard for complying with the helmet law, that explains why last year I rode around the entire year absolutely bareheaded. And my highest regards to the deputies and the highway patrolmen and the city police in this county who looked at that and have taken the time to look at the statute. I believe they've taken time to understand the law. I believe they've taken time to appreciate what it is that I'm doing, as opposed to just bucking up against it because I look like I'm lawless, and have allowed me to proceed with the only kind of demonstration that I know, and that is within the system to bring these things to their attention. I think that if we give up on the system and the belief that the system will work, if we give up on pushing back against it, then we're just inviting all kinds of I mean, it's the end to freedom. It's the end to freedom. We have nobody to blame but ourselves. It doesn't take much. People think that it's a huge problem because you got to convince all of these people not to do all of these terrible things, and it's not. It started with one single abuse at a time, and they compound against one another until they become a major mess. And so, anyway, I'm done with my Tuesday. I'm not going to be here for Thursday. I thank you, everybody, for listening. Bruce, thank you for calling in. Thank you, Michael, for letting me have the time. You guys have a great, sunshiny, beautiful day in paradise. This is Richard Quigley, KSCO AM 1080. It's 1 o'clock.